Before we start, if you're enjoying these conversations, please make sure that you like or subscribe to Cleaning Up. It really helps other people to find us.
Cleaning Up is brought to you by Capricorn Investment Group, the Liebreich Foundation, and the Gilardini Foundation. Hello, I'm Michael Liebreich, and this is Cleaning Up. Today, I'm joined by Jon Yadigaroglu and Dipender Saluja, two partners from Capricorn Investment Group. Capricorn is one of the largest mission-aligned investment firms in the world and, of course, the lead supporter of Cleaning Up. Regular listeners will recall that Jon joined us last season, episode 89, to talk us through some of the companies in Capricorn's investment portfolio. Today, they're going to be talking about the overall role of venture capital and the impact of the Inflation Reduction Act in the US on accelerating action on climate change. Please join me in welcoming Jon and Dipender to Cleaning Up. So Jon, welcome back to Cleaning Up, and Dipender, welcome to Cleaning Up.
Thank you, Michael. Very excited to be back here with you.
Good to be here.
Start, if we might. Jon, you were on episode 89, which was part of the last series, but if you could just remind everybody who you are, because we've got a lot of new listeners now, I'm glad to say. And then I'll turn to you, Dipender, and you can give us your sort of thumbnail sketch and bio. I always like to get that in your own words, because I'll just kind of get it wrong. Jon, you start.
Well, I'm a partner at Capricorn and also a co-GP of the Technology Impact Fund with Dipender.
Very good. Dipender.
Likewise, we're partners at Capricorn and managing the Technology Impact Fund as co-GPs. I'm based in Palo Alto and New York, and Jon is based in New York.
Dipender, give us a little thumbnail of your background. How did you get there? We already, you know, for those listeners who want the same for Jon, they can go back to episode 89 and do a deep dive. But what was your trajectory to end up applying this sort of capital to this particular set of problems?
Sure. So this September, I just completed 35 years here in Silicon Valley, within a couple of miles of where I'm sitting today. And the first half of my 35 years here was spent in the semiconductor industry. I started working in the semiconductor industry a few years before that. Did a variety of things in semiconductor physics, and then chip design, and then software for chip design, and kind of came full circle. And after doing that for, you know, a decade and a half for change, thought a lot about what was next. And we had spent a lot of time having fun building technology companies for the sake of, you know, technology. And one thing that was glaringly obvious was the gap between what we were doing here in Silicon Valley and some of the big, heavy industries like energy, like transportation, like space, healthcare, food, agriculture. And at the same time, we were seeing these huge problems looming with specifically things like energy and food. And there was always a metaphor that was developing here at that time, which was, if we could marry those two, imagine what could happen with industry at large. And Jon and I had known each other for a couple of decades at that point, had known each other for a long time. And when we put our heads together, this idea of investing in companies in energy, in transportation, and marrying those ideas with semiconductors, with software, with power electronics, with sensors, that whole gamut of technology that we had developed for years in Silicon Valley, and Silicon Valley was very good at, was clearly a big opportunity.
What? Which year did the two of you combine forces? When did you make the jump into the climate transition, the environmental space?
2006, if I remember correctly. I think we started talking in like 2005, and then in 2006, we started working together on this.
So now, I go back to 2006, and you were not the only Silicon Valley VC who jumped the divide, who decided they were now going to try and save the world. Very famously, of course, John Doerr, client of Perkins, very famous and very emotionally decided that he needed to apply his skills to this space. But very, very few of those people who jumped the divide have been successful. Why was your trajectory? What was it about your background that helped you to avoid the mistakes that were made around 2006, 2007, where vast amounts of capital was squandered?
Well, you're right in that there were a few people doing this. And by the way, you mentioned Kleiner. One of our early investments was, no surprise, a syndicate along with Kleiner as well. But from a pure focus on this space, it was a pretty lonely world. There were a handful of firms doing it, and we all talked a lot at that time. What you're referring to, I think, primarily is the fact that there were a lot of generalist VCs coming off of the successes of the dot-com boom that also decided to dabble in the space. And there were several who were doing, 80, 90% of what they were doing, what was core to their thesis, and then would do a couple of investments in the space, because for a lot of people, the opportunity, the big opportunity, was attractive. And I mean, there was no doubt that, yes, if you could change the automobile industry and build a new car company, that was going to be a big opportunity. It was just a question of what the approach would be and how do you do it. And Jan and I always thought, coming at it from a technology centric, technology heavy, differentiated technology point of view was the approach. And approaching it with that lens and doing the work to find those companies and find what would indeed be the special magic and the special sauce that would make these companies successful and do things in Silicon Valley almost for the first time. But if you think about it 15, 20 years ago and you go back and say, the world needs a completely new car company, very few people would have told you that that would happen in Silicon Valley. To us, that was kind of obvious.
That's so funny, because I had a conversation with Ira Ehrenpreis, who was one of the other early venture investors in Tesla. Actually had Nancy Fund was on this show as well. But my conversation with Ira back then was, you're mad. You're a Silicon Valley venture investor. What do you know about car companies? There have been no new ones. This is completely ridiculous. You should. And I had that conversation with him a number of times, saying, okay, fine, I was wrong, you were right. Sell everything though and get out, while the going's good. And he always said, no, you don't understand. And of course, I was just serially wrong on that one.
Yeah, and Jan and I spent a lot of time on the plane those years. We made many trips to Europe, to the automotive centers of Europe, to the automotive centers of America, to the automotive centers of Japan, and met with a lot of the senior leadership at the incumbent companies at that time. We even did a multi-day offsite in a beautiful automotive design center in the mountains of Austria with one of the most storied automotive companies. And when we talked about what we were thinking of building, in that case, it was a specific car. After an hour or two of us presenting our ideas, we got this team glaring at us and very pointedly, and I won't attempt an accent here, asked us if we were trying to build a car or a computer. And we said, well, it has to be a combination of both. And they said, we build cars, we don't build computers. And that was kind of, you know, and that was in 2007, if I remember correctly, Jan. And so that was sort of the essence of it. And as we, you know, met some of the senior leaders, they all said it was a good idea, but you could tell they had no intention of doing it because why do it, right? If you're in their place. And so when we came back, it wasn't that other folks couldn't do it or other regions couldn't do it or other companies couldn't do it. We could just tell that they weren't going to do it. And so it was, you know, maybe it was Silicon Valley that had nothing to lose by turning that status quo of automotive upside down is why they did.
Such strong resonance there with the experience of one of the very early guests on cleaning up, Bertrand Piccard. He and André Boschberg were the two guys who flew around the world in the Solar Aeroplane. And he talks on the show about how when he first sort of wanted to do this and he went to see Airbus and said, well, this is what we want to do. Will you work with us? And they said, they said, absolutely not, because it's impossible. And, you know, you're just going to crash and it's really bad. We're absolutely not. And so he needed to assemble an alliance from outside the aerospace industry in order to do this thing that all of the incumbents, you know, thought was impossible or possibly thought was possible, but had no interest whatsoever in actually doing. Now, of course, they've all got these huge programs for net zero aviation, electric aviation, so on. I'll come to you, Jan, around that same time, though, what most of the storied VCs did was they went into things like non-silicon based solar, so companies like Solyndra, and they went into next generation biofuels, and you went into Tesla and a bunch of other things. So there's still, I'm still looking for the kind of, why were you seeing the world differently? You know, what was it that you saw that's enabled you to have these, you know, very successful and, you know, such a successful portfolio?
Well, I don't think you, by the way, you didn't phrase the question right the first time around, because you said, how did a VC get into these things? Neither one of us were venture capitalists, certainly not generalists. So Dipender was coming out of 16 years at Cadence, and which is, you know, the core tool to design semiconductor chips and lots of other things since. And I was an astronomer who had spent a couple years investing and doing M&A in heavy industry, petrochemicals, things like that. So we had this big pile of money to deploy, and we had been trained and brainwashed in the Stanford kind of area and with all the entrepreneurs around. But we weren't trying to just find a new flavor of VC, right? This is the plan that we embarked on. And it wasn't, it was, how do we make huge money, huge success, and fix the world at the same time? It wasn't, how do I create a better venture fund? And so I think that gave us some insights and some emphasis that others didn't have. And as we've talked about, and many others have, I think in this space, it's really powerful to marry the technical expertise with the investment acumen. It's very tough to make good decisions if you're a generalist.
That's...
Now, I'll also tell you, by the way, just for fun, we love Ira. We've invested in quite a few companies with him. We actually invested in one round earlier than Tesla. We wrote a very similar check. I think it was at Series D. And like all the VC in Tesla, they distributed shares in their entirety post IPO, not necessarily a day after, but let's say within a year. What he was really smart, he's a very smart guy that's done a lot of great things for Tesla and others, but what he did is he never sold his board shares. And that ended up being worth, like, I don't know, $700 million, I think, down the road. So that was a really extraordinary record of as a board member of Tesla, and of course all the ups and downs, including all the litigation that's ongoing today. So the poor fellow has been drawn into every problem that the company has faced.
Not being drawn into the whole you know, Elon does Twitter and et cetera problems, which are...
He's got all that fun. He's handled the comp packages, the SEC settlement. He's had to handle all that stuff. So he's been, he's certainly been rewarded for it, but there's been a cost.
I want to move on to...
On your prior question, by the way.
Yep, Deepak, come in.
Michael, I'm assuming you can edit and stitch all this. On your prior question, there is one other point to make, which is, you know, coming from the semiconductor industry, we were used to chips doubling in performance every year and a half, couple of years, you know, the famous Moore's Law. And you know, when people hear Moore's Law, they think it may be something, you know, that's a law of science. It was really an observation. Yep. It wasn't, you know, but it turned into a law because it was almost that predictable. But if you think about it, when you look at the energy industry at that time, and most of it even today, if you look at automotive, you know, these were primarily, and this is a much longer conversation, but just, you know, to use a few words, it's bending steel and combining it with other materials and then process engineering, you know, all of what goes into building large plants or machines. None of those really had that Moore's Law approach or benefit. So one of the things that was really the magic and that then unfolded over the last couple of decades, and we hope for, you know, several decades going forward, was that marrying of a Moore's Law concept, literally and figuratively. Literally because you were introducing semiconductor content. I'm sure some speaker on your show has told you the increasing cost of electronics in automotive and the increasing share of electronics dollars in a car. That's not by accident. That's because of increasing semiconductor and technology share. And that has come in almost every layer of the car. And there's a bunch of it that was irrespective of whether they were electric cars or internal combustion engines. But then the essence of what was in an electric car was really the power electronics. And that power electronics that was introduced in these cars came out of decades of development in the quote unquote pure traditional semiconductor world. And that has almost gotten amped up, you know, several orders of magnitude since electric cars and then other electric drive propulsion systems and power conversion systems, whether in automotive or solar or nuclear fusion and on, get developed. And so it was, there was a literal merger of the traditional industries with semiconductor and software. And then there was a figurative one where once that started happening, people got spoiled by the speed of innovation and by the speed of or the advantage of that innovation and having that unreasonable expectation of the speed of how things should innovate. So that got translated even into unreasonable ways of building cars and saying, you know, we're not gonna go in with a piece of paper that has a starting date today and an ending date 15 years from now, because that's how you start thinking about building one of these products. You took pieces of paper that said, I'll have a starting date of today and an ending date of 3 to 5 years instead of 10 to 15 years. I'm just using a broad brush here. But that change of mentality meant people started thinking about different ways of doing things and saying it's not okay to say just because we've always done it that it's going to take us this long to build a new car. We'll do it in half the time, or anything else for that matter, whether it was a power plant or a car or anything from that.
Where I came across this is this came home to me when I was on the board of Transport for London, and we were spending plus or minus £10 billion a year on everything, capital cost and running cost. And I asked, how much are we spending on IT programming, you know, anywhere in the business? And they didn't know. And they came back and they said £300 million. And I said, well, how much are your contractors spending? Do you include that? And they said, no. And I said, well, then that's the wrong number. And eventually we found that it was something like £1 billion. So 10% of everything was actually IT, and not one person on the board and not one person in senior management had ever done any programming or managed any programmers. And so for me, it was the same thing. There's this kind of, I don't know if it's software eats transportation, software or silicon and software eats cars. It eats the value add. You're right.
Yeah. And I think the whole genesis of software eats was all inclusive. It was all of this in approach for technology, because at the end of the day, the software needs appropriate hardware to be able to eat anything. And so the combination of the two, but in our case, there was an even more direct application of that hardware, right? Because it also meant what happened to the power electronics, what happened to the drivetrains, what happened to the conversion systems, and on and on and on.
I want to get to this hardware question because to look at it through the frame of the capital markets, the whole capital stack, because, you know, there's the venture investment, but then in every case, anything to do with, particularly with climate change, it's stuff that emits. It's not the software and it's not the silicon bit. It's not the silicon value add. It is the infrastructure, the vehicle, the heating system, the industrial system. And those do tend to require, they do require vastly more capital than the VC bit or the technology development bit. So you need a kind of bucket chain of all the different types of capital. And how, I want to talk to how that bucket chain gets assembled, and then we'll get on to how that's now being, in a sense, hacked by the US Inflation Reduction Act and by other policy interventions around the world. So if we can move on to how that stack gets assembled, and maybe, Jan, you and I have spoken about this in the context, in fact, we on the earlier show, we sort of promised, I promised that I'd get back to you to talk about whether ESG is a sufficiently powerful sort of tool to get that whole capital stack realigned around these solutions that we're talking about.
Well, of course not. Did you want the long answer?
I was hoping you would elaborate rather than give the summary of several conversations we've had.
Yeah, look, to try to not spend time being negative, but focus on the positive, all these things have some role to play. So I don't mean to be unduly harsh, but no, there's the effectiveness of big amorphous frameworks like ESG ideas to actually result in a coal plant getting shut down is slow, indirect, and very unsatisfactory. Absolutely. And we've been much more excited about more direct mechanisms to get stuff done. And you're right that this is, look, I've been obsessed for, I don't want to exaggerate, at least 20 years with, okay, we can invent the technology. Look, all of us here are either engineers or physicists. We all love talking about, you know, what new things we can build and with what new technology. And that's where all the hope and the excitement is. But coming from it from the totally opposite side, the world needs to do tens of trillions of infrastructure with this new tech and needs to do it within, you know, 20 years. Never been done before. It's a big chunk of all the money available in the world has to be deployed in a very short amount of time to build new clean and green infrastructure. And so, yes, our work at the opposite end, you know, it starts in one side with chemistry and physics and engineering in a lab, but it very quickly has to connect with, you know, many trillions of dollars of sovereign retirement system type capital in the world that needs to go and build tens of trillions of, in the end, low risk, boring infrastructure. And if you don't understand how those two worlds are going to connect and connect really fast, then we're screwed. Sorry, we're not going to solve the climate problem.
My guest on episode 84, so just 5 weeks before you, was Mark Carney. I mean, he went off to Glasgow. He assembled a coalition of $130 trillion. And he's just saying, look, Jan, look, here's the money. These people, you know, have said they're going to invest. So why is there still a problem?
Yeah, so he's been very, very visible, very influential, and I've met him a bunch of times, as you know, very nice fellow. But I think that effort has not done what it needs to do. And I think it's for really simple reasons. So of course, the last couple of years, to oversimplify, have really been channeled into this idea of net zero. And into the idea that if we build this giant coalition of investors, shareholders that ascribe to net zero, and the CEOs ascribe to it, that there's going to be some kind of virtuous cycle that makes it all work. But you know, the promoters, the key people behind net zero are all in the end coming from the financial management of either the banks or the large sovereign funds or the large asset managers. And it's really in the end a framework designed to deflect from the need from regulation, in my opinion. So it's designed to be a voluntary framework, so we don't have to get more serious about things that might be harder hitting. And it's very deliberate in that it has really no impact on money. What it is it's supposed to be a cheerleading function, maybe a policing function over time, although that's not the case yet, that tells CEOs, you better sign up for net zero by, you know, 2050, hopefully earlier, 2030, 2035, whatever you can do. And over time, we're going to complain more and more bitterly if you haven't signed up to a framework and if your framework isn't real. But over the next years, it has no real consequence for those who hold a whole bunch of money in their bank account, or it's their job to deploy and allocate that money. It's designed to not have that impact. And so, of course, it's not actually in practice moving things forward. And a lot of CEOs that I meet are pretty irate that the trillions of money in the world has signed up to being a cheerleader and a policeman. They're the ones that have, you know, 100,000 jobs each and operating on 3% margins, and they have to somehow magically decarbonize. And there's no real, you know, net zero does not result in them getting access to cheaper capital or free technology or anything like that, right? It's just all supposed to happen magically. Yeah.
When you said it's a mechanism, so net zero is a mechanism to avoid regulation, I think that's the words you used. What is the regulation that fixes it? Is it financial regulation, or is it regulation in the real economy, or is that not the right? Are neither of those the right answer, and something else is?
Look, I think that you know I don't want to repeat the thing that everyone has said 1,000 times is very true, that America always does the right thing after having tried absolutely everything else. But in this case, I think it's true. I think America, in the end, has figured out that the right way to tackle this is through something that's like the IRA. By the way, there is a definitive answer, which is it's called the IRA and not the IRA. I heard you say IRA before. I think it's now definitive. It's IRA.
Yes. It also needs, we have a, I forgot to warn you before we started, I have an acronym klaxon. It's not a real one yet. I must get one. Yes. Because not everybody will know what IRA stands for.
The Inflation Reduction Act.
The Inflation Reduction Act, exactly.
And of course, if you say IRA, is it still an acronym? Because I'm not actually saying the letters.
This is a good and complex discussion, because, of course, over in the UK, we always hesitate before saying the words IRA because of the connotations of the Troubles and so on. So I love the idea that I can now call it the IRA, because I don't have to then hesitate. So it's the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, and you played a role in its creation, if I understand, at least behind the scenes. And you're now going to tell us why sort of breaks this deadlock that I posed, the conundrum that I posed. You're saying, no, the answer is something different.
Yeah. So if you want to do this unnatural act, I mean, the world would end up electrifying, decarbonizing either way, right? The problem is that we have to do it so fast. Yeah. And the world has never done anything this fast before, not even close. So again, something like 10, 20, 30% of all money in the world has to be redeployed in the span of 10 or 20 years to build new stuff, right? That's just astoundingly difficult challenge. And it's all possible. It's just that you have to, you know, invent new mechanisms to do it. The normal mechanisms weren't going to work. And there are different approaches, but certainly, for instance, Europe has tended to veer towards regulation. And that sounds like, you know, a bad word. You know, you can write good regulation, essentially laws that tell people that they have to comply with higher and higher standards of things like carbon footprints or whatnot. You know, the American approach in the end has mostly been now, ever since this was signed, to focus on stimulus in the right areas, right? Subsidy to the right critical industries. And so largely, and there's bits and pieces of things everywhere, but largely right now, America has a subsidy, a giant, giant subsidy regime for the critical climate technologies. Europe is largely still stuck trying to do some regulation around key industries. And you could have imagined there being, and I still think there should be a role for regulation in how money is allocated and invested. But really net zero has deflected the attention from that. So largely in the world, there are no regulations related to how money has to be used, even though we know that money has to be used in a way that is completely different than it has been ever, right? No, there's been no mechanism there's only 250 trillion maybe of investable capital in the world, most of it in sovereign systems and retirement systems, a little bit in insurance float, and even less in terms of family savings and individual and corporate wealth. And a huge chunk of that has to go build stuff tomorrow, the next 10, 20 years.
Jon, every economist, including Lord Stern, who was also a guest on this show, Nick Stern, who's a good friend going back many years, every economist will tell you the answer is a carbon price. And the EU, with the EU ETS, did a carbon price. You know, Canada has innovated and has got this kind of carbon tax and dividend, which even allows it to be politically acceptable. So why is that not the right answer? Why are you excited about the IRA, but you're not mourning the fact that you don't have a carbon price?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I'm the kind of person that usually makes that mistake because we're nerds. We think with our brainy heads, what should it be, as opposed to what actually works. And we've known that the carbon price has been a really difficult sell everywhere and for a very long time. Now, could that change? Maybe. But when something isn't working for human reasons, political and other human reasons, well, move on. Just let's do stuff that actually works. And I think that's where the genius of the IRA has come in. So you gave me an excuse to take some credit for it, so I will. But, you know, as I said, I've been really worried, concerned about this, thinking about how we can solve this. And to make matters worse, for a very long time, right? Certainly 20 years, let's say. And when you talk to Stern or other really wise people, and you say, well, they must have a plan. Well, no one's had a plan. There's really been no plan. And the bits of planning that might have happened before 2009 were all wiped up out by the financial crisis in 2008 and 9. After 2008 and 9, it's become impossible to talk about large scale financial mechanisms to do things because the world almost disintegrated into protectionist thinking because, you know, money was going from Germany into Ireland and from Germany into Greece and from, you know, certain states in America and to other states that were affected differently by the financial crisis. And ever since then, looking at these kind of huge flows of capital to fix a problem have been politically and societally unappealing. Like, people just don't want to do them. And so you have to find other ways. And the genius that we've had here with the IRA, and this was deliberate, was to say, look, we just have to tie it to jobs. And we have to tie it. So you take a list of where is the world going to create the most jobs? What 5, 6, 7 industries are going to create the most jobs over the next couple of years, next, let's say, 20 years? And they have to be good jobs. They can't just be service jobs or installation jobs. They have to be real jobs, you know, blue collar, manufacturing, bending steel, like Dipender said, kind of jobs. And then we're going to tie all of that flow of money to that. And that is what makes it acceptable and appealing. And even more extraordinary is that I think it's the only chance we have of tackling the cross-border version of all this, because most of that money, most of those tens of trillions today are in places like America, Europe, and Japan. And it mostly needs to end up in places like Indonesia and Nigeria. And if you thought it was hard enough to come up with climate finance solutions in our own countries, it's beyond depressing when you think about how to do that between, let's say, America and Nigeria, okay, or whatever pair you want to take. And so the extraordinary thing about the IRA is that it also allows for that. So as long as, right, the IRA subsidizes the factory, and once it starts producing, it subsidizes the products leaving that factory, and does so to a huge degree. Like batteries, it's, you know, about a third of what a battery costs today is just paid for by the American government. And you can just turn around and ship that battery to Nigeria, no problem. You get the money either way. As long as the jobs in America and the supply chain that fed up to that factory is increasingly American. And so this is going to become the largest cross-border financing mechanism ever.
I mean, that's a really fascinating insight, that there's going to be essentially, the US is going to be subsidizing factories and production using essentially through tax breaks, but the output will go off into the developing world, will go everywhere in the world, frankly. It doesn't matter where it's going to. But it is conditional on the recipient country, for instance, in Nigeria, being able to buy that battery. So doesn't it?
Sure, but if the battery is half the cost, you're helping them.
You're helping them, but the net flow of capital, of cash, is going from Nigeria to the US, is it not?
Absolutely. But so you kind of have to divide the world into two types of countries, countries that had ambition to win in these sectors and countries that frankly don't. And was Nigeria ever really going to become a global center of battery manufacturing or EV manufacturing or solar
batteries
cell
or EV? But certainly I haven't looked at the data, but I bet you they have battery, they have precursor materials, they've got the minerals, they've got all sorts of things. And they've certainly got the energy required, the wind and the solar and the geothermal, whatever, to make, to supply battery manufacturers elsewhere.
Yeah. So look, if again, you're putting back your engineer's mind on, like if you could reorder the world and say, let's be fair and as efficient as and optimal as possible, then that's what should happen. I think that's actually the wrong answer. We don't have time to do all that. We have to do unnatural acts.
Let me just bring Dipender in. I want to come back to some of these questions, but I want to bring Dipender in. You're working, presumably you work closely with your portfolio companies. You certainly talk to the executives all the time. What has been their response? I mean, I just want to get, have you got any kind of concrete examples of a company that was going to do X and now because of IRA, they're going to do Y, and to confirm that it is going to have this kind of open checkbook impact on their investment plans?
So yes, first reactions pretty much across the board is how do we accelerate building? And again, if we go back to, you know, the start of the discussion and what was happening a couple of decades ago, Almost always, the biggest risk of any of these new companies being able to progress to the next stage was financing, and financing primarily to cross the chasm, to use another Silicon Valley term, which is, you know, how do you scale from innovating to manufacturing and then scaling manufacturing and delivering the product? And so it's having that desired effect, which is all of these companies are accelerating their plans to manufacture the product as opposed to wait for years to figure out, you know, how all of that patches up, or take baby steps when indeed the world is ready for the product at scale. And so to answer your question specifically, yes, the executives and the companies are putting their heads together and saying, how do we deploy faster than we had planned? Because that long tail, or the long pole in that tent of capital availability to manufacture may now be available better and faster, and frankly cheaper.
Has the telephone been ringing off the hook with European companies saying, would you like to finance? We're thinking of actually building a plant in the US or moving our headquarters to the US, but obviously that requires another fundraise. Are you hearing those sorts of inquiries?
So, you know, for us, where our tool is primarily venture capital, and by the way, that includes growth capital, you know, we're not the people that
right.
a large established industrial tech company will call and say, are you interested, right? So we would hear from startups. Over the last, you know, again, decade or so, many of the companies that are doing a lot of work in the space that we're familiar with are primarily happen to be US-based as well. And a lot of them happen to be, you know, right here in Silicon Valley.
The reason I ask is because sitting here in Europe, I know of a number of companies that are actually facing that kind of, you know, the crossing the chasm challenge, or the valley of death, or whatever you want to call it, moving from innovation to manufacturing. And quite a few of them are wondering whether their future actually is in the US. Now, what that...
Repeat? Yeah, no, I was going to say, to me, actually, one of the better outcomes of this would be every region decide to go forward and accelerate the manufacturing of these technologies in the way that the IRA bill promises to do. And then you even remove the next layer, which is we need every company and every industry in every part of the world to act and accelerate and scale this decarbonization and moving to a better product. And so I don't think it's wonderful that we can address this with a bunch of companies, but I don't think our desire is to say, let's address this with companies here within, you know, a 500-mile radius of where we're sitting. And then maybe 10 years from now, companies outside of this area will start doing it.
Right. But that brings me to some of the pushback that is now gathering in Europe, saying that these are, in some cases, you know, just consumer subsidies that quite clearly are going to infringe WTO rules, at least so the Europeans, so those people in Europe would say. And, you know, aren't there a couple of potentially less attractive futures? So one where this gets mired in a trade war, and the other, maybe depending, as you said, that all regions of the world start to, you know, compete for subsidies and they start throwing money through subsidies at this, but that it's just badly done. I mean, we've seen enormous subsidies thrown at, you will no doubt know the story better than me, the European mainframe computer sector, which everybody wanted to win, but didn't win. And so you know, is this not also, frankly, quite a risky route to go? Jan, you wanted to come in.
Having European, having grown up in Europe, I may be more comfortable saying that the Europeans should stop being sissies and get off their rear ends and actually get some work done on this front. So the regulatory approach, the cajoling of big companies, all that is just not working in Europe. And on top of that, you had high labor costs, you have this exploding energy cost, all the disruption due to Ukraine. So it's really bleak right now in Europe. Very bleak.
On state aid rules in Europe, which are very, very stringent.
Yeah.
So, and those were designed to stop intra-Europe competition. So you can't have Germany just saying, right, we're going to just pay this much for, you know, for somebody to go and make solar panels or batteries or whatever it is, because then that would upset the French, the Italians at the time, the British, and so on. So you're hamstrung by that institutional framework, are you not?
So again, you had told me, you know, what role did we have in this? And so I kind of never got around to that, but it answers this question. During the Biden campaign, I felt, and many felt, that, you know, climate was just not strongly addressed. And I started joining every group and committee and meeting I could. And I thought a lot of the ideas were frankly pretty junky. I think there's a lot of things that sounded right in the Green New Deal and the Sunrise Movement, but when you looked under the covers, they weren't going to get the job done. So I'm trying to say that there's people like myself and others that put a lot of energy and thought into how do you do this the right way. The biggest piece of the IRA when it comes to climate is a new thing that I started evangelizing 2 years ago called the manufacturing PTC. And it was, by the way, not part of the drafts for 2 years. It got revived at the last minute when Manchin and a few others, but primarily Manchin, decided to nix most of the other proposals. And frankly, thank God, because a lot of the proposals were really not very good. And so again, I don't mean to be the apologist for exactly how this process worked, because the sausage making is just unbearably hard to follow and to like, but I think the outcome's actually pretty good. And the manufacturing PTC is very fair. It says, again, it's a national program, so it's unfair from the perspective of, you know, trade, let's say, of open trade. But it is very fair in that if you make a battery, it doesn't matter, you know, who you are and who your friends are, it will pay you $45 for that battery. And if you make a solar cell, it will pay you whatever, right? I mean, the spec of what you need to make and what you'll get for it is very egalitarian, very open. So intra-Europe needs to create mechanisms like this. It can't be this constant horse trading of, well, I'm going to put $1 billion into southern Spain because, you know, you got $500 million for eastern France, right? That's where this all goes wrong. Now, you could also look, there are for sure dangers with the IRA. I mean, some of the incentive levels are so high that they're very distortive, but we need that.
I'm looking at $3 per kilo of green hydrogen. I'm thinking, why don't we just go and put non-grid connected, solar green hydrogen? We could vent it, we could flare it, we could mine Bitcoin. Just don't even bother with a grid connection and we're going to get super rich, no?
Yeah, in my battery memo from 2 years ago, I sent to everybody at the campaign, had said $25 phase to zero for batteries over 10 years. The current legislation says 45 fixed for 10 years. So I'll agree with you. And certainly hydrogen is the most offensive one at scale. There's some offensive ones that are small, but hydrogen at $3 is really, really too large. And certainly keeping it there for 10 years is down in insanity. But look, I'll take that, right? I'll take that over nothing. And the fact is that, you know, I went to the party where this thing was signed, after this thing was signed, and there was a few thousand people there. We all single-handedly believed, each one of us, that we had made the IRA happen, and there was a few thousand people. But, you know, I think in my case, it's true. No, I say that tongue in cheek. No, I do think that there was a lot of big moments that could have killed this. And I think putting the right idea forward and sticking with it for 2 years. And we used a young, really talented lobbyist called Isaac Brown to kind of shop this, explain this all over. And he did an extraordinary job. And we did it really because we felt it was the right thing, right? We're not like one company with one agenda trying to make a buck here. We spent that money and time because we think that this was the best way to do it. And I think, like Dipender said, we're hoping that this ignites a global arms race on subsidies for climate tech. This is the only way, Michael, that we're going to get tens of trillions spent, with most of that money getting shipped in this strange indirect way to places like Indonesia and Nigeria, because it's coming with a European job or an American job or an Asian job in China or Korea. This is the only way that it's going to happen that I see.
Now, this is fascinating, and I kind of get an insight as to how, you know, I have this image of you, Jan, you know, working on trying to get IRA done and Dipender quietly sort of running the business in the background. Maybe that's not accurate, but I like to think it's like that. How do we move forward? There's one area. I also have a role. I'm an advisor.
Michael, if I can interrupt, because I just want to give one more color, piece of color. I mean, you cannot underestimate how there's been no answer, especially when it comes to cross-border climate finance. It's not that we're almost there. Without a global arms race that resembles IRA, we are so far from solving this problem, and we have no time left. And there's not even a catalyst for it to get solved. It's not like the politicians are getting better and better at talking about how we as rich countries should subsidize where most of the energy and fuel growth is, which is in poor countries. So until we had this tool, I was unbelievably bleak in my mind around the options we had. And it really, to me, it's been like a revelation the last 2 years to realize, you know what, if we tie it in the right way to jobs, it becomes acceptable. And to illustrate this, imagine shipping even $1 billion to a place like, you know, Bangladesh. Remember, you're not just shipping the money there, but it has to be almost free money. People brag about, you know, I make 11% in a wind project, 11% return. What that means is that if it's compounding at that rate of return for 10 years, which is not even enough for a wind project to work, right? It's got to be 20 or 30 years. That means I'm getting three times my money back. Do we really think we're helping Bangladesh if we ship them $1 billion, demanding $3 billion back in 10 years? It's a joke, right? And it just doesn't work. So we have to find ways to not just ship trillions into places like Bangladesh, but we have to do it with essentially free money. And anyone's reaction who is an investor like us, when you say, I'm going to build permanent green infrastructure in Bangladesh that I may or may not get paid for over the next 20 years, immediately reacts by saying, okay, I'll do it, but if you pay me 20% return. So those problems have been totally disconnected. And politicians, big bankers, sovereign managers have all been like going to conferences, no solution. Absolutely no solution. That's why, look, in the end, I do appreciate Mike Carney and others. I mean, look, they all have their heart in the right place. But all this talk is just deflecting from like real solutions. And the IRA, in the end, it takes, you know, the cycle of that government money is like 60 days. So you get real money to ship a product right now, starting January 1st. And that money is gone. It's free. No one's paying it back. Right, we as a society might, but we're okay with that.
I see the impact of the IRA in terms of driving manufacturing, well, driving the investment in manufacturing and then the manufacturing. The stuff about Bangladesh, though, I think I need to think a bit harder about the flows of cash, because what you're doing is you're reducing the cost of that wind farm in Bangladesh, but somebody still needs to put in the capital and earn their whatever. So I think you've made the problem easier, but you haven't provided the capital for the wind farm in Bangladesh, which is what the kind of 100 billion Copenhagen supposed to be.
You know, I know, look, being 20 years in physics prior to this kind of work, I kind of know the difference between real science and pseudoscience. A lot of this economic stuff is pseudoscience. People oversimplify the problems, right? So it's really hard to actually get to sound conclusions in economics, right? And a lot of this stuff are abstractions that can be helpful to understand a problem, but don't answer it. And so, you know, how a country Again, countries like Bangladesh, they have a real economy. They're able to afford power if it's affordable. They want the power. A lot of people can pay for it. It just can't be three times more expensive than burning coal, right? It's got to be as cheap or cheaper. And when you lower the cost of the products that build that infrastructure by half, well, that power becomes twice as competitive. It's really, in my view, it's really that's the dominant simplification. And those countries actually have the ability to pay for a lot of stuff if it is priced right.
And I buy that. I buy that. I want to move on. I want to actually, we're coming to the close of the time slot. I just want to, I have a role as an advisor to the UK government on trade. So I'm an advisor to the UK Board of Trade. And I'm just wondering whether the, you know, coming back to this question of whether the, you know, the next step is going to be to apply that same young lobbyist to the Global Trade Organization to make sure that what you get is this kind of constructive race to clean technologies rather than just, you know, 10 years of litigation through the WTO, just grinding everybody down as, you know, as it would do.
Look, the I don't think, and again, it's not like Dipender and I spend our time going to WTO, you know, meetings or anything like that, right? So we're certainly, but I think WTO has essentially become irrelevant to this. Well, the political, the what Europe, look, most American companies right now that want to build billions of dollars worth of batteries or solar cells don't really care if they sell any in Europe. For any one of these products, in the same way that the tens of trillions are going to Bangladesh or Nigeria or India, that's where you want to sell this stuff. That's where you're going to end up selling it, right? It's the same problem. So Europe is, I don't mean to say that it remains a significant market. I'm speaking in black and white terms to make the point, but Europe cannot get out of this issue by huffing and puffing and talking about how pissed off they are. I mean, if instead of subsidizing a trillion euros worth of high energy prices overnight to keep the politics intact, half of that money had gone into a first version of an IRA bill, we'd be way better along in Europe, right? Europe is just failing to lead on.
Trade wars are not just between Europe and the US. I mean, I suppose, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years and I've seen the solar trade wars between China and the US, China and Europe. We've had you know, a number of very damaging, I mean, things that really push up the costs, things that really stop companies from succeeding. The rare earth wars where China refused to sell rare earths to Japan. And you know, these things are really damaging. If we go down that route, I don't think that the industry just kind of, you know, flies through it without problem, given how international these supply chains are.
But that's why I think, as I said, I think that, and it's obviously more complicated, and for sure there are huge risks and pitfalls, and that's why we need fantastic leadership. But it is worth it. You know, taking I think the estimates for what IRA is going to cost are vastly, vastly underestimated. I think that it will end up costing, you know, trillions of dollars. And America can afford that. And those trillions are largely going to get shipped to countries that need those products. And it's going to create millions of jobs in America, which is what we need here. Now, every country needs them, but realistically, most of these countries that need all this, you know, these vast, vast green infrastructure never had a real chance at winning and becoming the manufacturing jobs in some of these things that remain really difficult to do. Now, are they going to be suppliers of certain things? And does the IRA try to sort of bias that towards American? Yes, it does. And by the way, it does great things like focus it on recycling of those primary products. But we will find bilateral ways to work with the largest off-takers of these products that have, for instance, the right minerals that go into them. So yes, there's a very stark, you know, I mean, the biggest version of the negative here is, like, you know, the anti-China aspect to this bill, okay? And so that's obviously the biggest opportunity and the biggest risk is that that gets out of hand. But as you know, there's also deep, deep alignment between the countries and what needs to get done. And China wasn't exactly playing fair until now. unlike Europe, they have huge advantages to bring to this. So it's not as black and white as it seems, right? So Americans are not immediately going to eat the lunch of every Chinese company as a result. I think Europe really needs to react much, much more strongly than they have, and not in negative ways, in ways that favor its own industry.
Fascinating, because one of our last episodes was with Nobuo Tanaka, who's the former executive director of the International Energy Agency. He was talking also about this, the great clean energy acceleration, the fact that we're now moving to great block competition to deliver these technologies and to move faster. And he was extremely bullish, sitting not in Europe, about Europe's prospects in this new competitive environment.
Look, I think we have real advantages in Europe, again, being born and raised there. We have incredible educational systems. We have extraordinary infrastructure, educational infrastructure, cultural infrastructure, industrial infrastructure. We have lots of great things to rely on, but it's hard not to be critical of recent leadership coming from the government, political system, and large corporates. And so much of the time and money is being spent on just kind of keeping things together and on all this sort of, you know, horse trading of, well, you get this because I get that, as opposed to sound, objective, large programs that would help all industry where it merits to move forward and compete with America and compete with China, Korea.
Very good. Now, I want to wrap up. Dipender has been listening to the to and fro on this. And just wondering if you had any closing thoughts for us there, Dipender.
No, I mean, we covered some very, very broad topics today. And so I don't know if connecting them is that important, but, some of this has happened before, right? So, I mean, you brought up computing, and I think computing is an area where it's very clear how prices globally and access globally moved faster than any industry had before. And it's almost become a cliche and a metaphor for how people are used to products costing them half of what they used to a couple of years, or if not costing them half of what they used to, getting twice the capability, or just this steep curve of improving base, both features and access. And I think there's a chance we could do that with things like energy and transportation and industries that nobody had ever imagined could move at that pace. And over the last 20 years, you've seen that happen with solar. As we sit here and we look at the most optimistic forecasts of whether it was price or scale or extent, some of those forecasts that were for 2050 or even longer have already been blown away. Some of those forecasts that said it would take, just restating the obvious again, decades have happened in just a couple of years. And so that's a beautiful thing, right? When you think about it. And at the end of the day, consumers all around the world have benefited from it. Consumers all around the world are benefiting from first order effects of getting that cheap electricity that Jan just talked about. And now consumers and people are going to see the benefits of the second order effect of that, which is making everything that uses electricity is going to get dramatically cheaper or has gotten dramatically cheaper. And making things in ways that were just physics experiments before, because the cost of electricity or energy to use those techniques to build products in that way were prohibitively expensive. And now it opens up a whole new economy and a whole new way of doing things, hydrogen being one. So I think there's a lot of good that comes out of getting a lot of the world to focus on how to accelerate and build these things. And our hope is that that's what happens with all of this.
That's a great summary. So much resonance there. So many things that I would love to chase and continue on, but we are out of time. I very much hope that our conversations will continue. And I'd like to thank you for spending time here today with me on Cleaning Up.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. And it sounds like we're going to shut the camera off and have a strong debate that continues.
So that was Janja Dzigoroglu and Dipender Saluja, two partners with Capricorn Investment Group, the lead supporter of Cleaning Up. Next week's episode will be an audio version of my upcoming blog for Bloomberg NEF. And I warn you, it might mention the hydrogen word. So please join me at this time next week for the next episode of Cleaning Up. Cleaning Up is brought to you by Capricorn Investment Group, the Liebreich Foundation, and the Gilardini Foundation.